This is the Ag Market Network's monthly cotton conference call, brought to you by Cotton Incorporated and by Certified Fibermax. You can find more online at agmarketnetwork.net.
We want to welcome everyone today to the Ag Market Network, to our May the 13th edition of our program. I'm Pat McClatchy. Want to let everybody know the opinion of our speakers today is not necessarily the opinion of our sponsors or the Ag Market Network. We want to recognize and thank our sponsors, Bayer Crop Science, also Cotton Incorporated, and Farm Press Publications. We appreciate them bringing this program to you. Joining us today is our distinguished cotton panel made up of Dr. O.A. Cleveland, Dr. John Robinson, and Gerald Nieper. And today's feature speaker is Kip Butts. He's also a member of our cotton panel. Kip is senior cotton analyst and director of energy services at Informa Economics. Kip?
I'm here.
All right, go ahead and get started. We're ready.
Okay. Thank you very much, Pat. Pat and I spoke a few weeks ago. Pat expressed a desire to cover some topics that are not just supply-demand oriented, which tend to dominate our monthly discussions. He specifically mentioned that the U.S. dollar's influence on price. I will discuss from about 50,000 feet the U.S. dollar and a few other topics that are not necessarily directly supply-demand oriented, but can at times have an influence on price. Please be aware that for the sake of brevity and the early hour, I will talk only on high points, leaving some detail out of this discussion. I shall first discuss the U.S. dollar, some of the impacts of non-commercial participation on the futures market, and then a mention of the cotton on-call report. First, we need to recognize in any discussion of the U.S. dollar, the correlation is not necessarily causation, but the correlations have improved recently, and there are reasons to believe that some causation is involved. First, a bit of background on how we got here and how the U.S. dollar became what it is today. The U.S. dollar is what's called a fiat currency, in that it's controlled by the Federal Open Market Committee of the Federal Reserve System and is not backed by any real asset. It's essentially valueless and is used only as a medium of exchange. Previously, the U.S. dollar had an intrinsic value when it was pegged to either gold or silver. The advantage of a fiat currency to a commodity-backed currency is that the fiat currency is not limited to the availability or supply of the commodity that backs the currency. The fiat currency then affords the opportunity for a faster rate of growth and essentially allows for unfettered monetary expansion. The U.S. dollar has been the de facto currency for international trade since the Bretton Woods Conference in 1944. Actually, the reserve currency formally occurred in 1971 when President Nixon took the U.S. off the gold standard. It was at this point the U.S. dollar became a pure fiat currency. Several major currencies were pegged either to gold or a basket of currencies at the time the U.S. severed the relationship with gold, and those currencies converted to a free-floating currency system as well, in large part for trade reasons. Because the U.S. was already the international trade currency, it became the world's reserve currency, and much of the world trade was therefore traded in U.S. dollars. Therefore, commodities traded in the world currency are at the mercy of the U.S. dollar value. There is an inverse relationship to the value of U.S. dollar and prices of currencies, but only at times. You may have noticed, too, that it's only been recently that the U.S. dollar has caught the attention of journalists and talking heads in their discussion about commodities. We talk about that reason, or the reason for that, rather, in just a few moments. Excuse me. The relationship is really very simple in theory, but is a bit more complex in reality. The general theory is that if the U.S. dollar increases in value, then the commodity becomes more expensive to importers, whose currency has lost value to the reserve currency. The flat price of the commodity in dollar terms must be lowered to allow the importers to get the product at a less inflated price. Also, it's in the best interest of the exporters to lower the cost of the commodity in nominal dollars or risk losing sales of exports. It's for this reason the commodity should have an inverse relationship with the U.S. dollar. Simple, right? Well, like Inspector Renault in the movie Casablanca, we would be shocked, no, really shocked, to find the governments would use the ability of the fiat currency to manipulate markets. However, the fiat free-floating currencies are in fact subject to government manipulation. When an economy begins to falter and needs a boost, often devaluing a currency is a method to increase exports and increase their trade. Another example of manipulation is the implementation of a quantitative easing program, which Japan, the U.S., China, and EU have recently embarked. The results of that action to date have proved less beneficial than had hoped. And now that the markets are used to a zero interest rate policy, it will be difficult for participants to adjust to a normalization of rates when that finally occurs. Since the international trading system has switched to a free-floating currency environment, a sharp increase in the use of monetary policy has largely replaced fiscal policy as a means of maintaining market balance. However, even Sir Maynard Keynes, who is the father of modern monetary policy, would shudder at the thought of using only monetary policy to maintain market equilibrium. The government manipulation of currencies and the dominance of the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency, as other countries have grown in size and importance in the international marketplace, has some countries establishing bilateral trade agreements that include dollar provisions, allowing countries to bypass the U.S. dollar entirely. The most obvious pushback on the International Monetary Fund, and to a lesser degree the Bank of International Settlements, is the establishment of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. However, that bank faces many hurdles that will not be easy to overcome and may take years to be a factor in the international market, if it ever occurs. The expression that we're all Keynesians now, coined by Milton Friedman and popularized with Nixon's termination of the gold standard, is appropriate these days, with Denmark, Switzerland, and a handful of others whose central banks have adopted a negative nominal interest rate policy to attempt to kickstart consumer spending. That action, of course, weakens their currencies against the U.S. dollar. For that matter, the U.S. has become wholly dependent on the FOMC for its guidance, and monetarists are trying to accomplish both the role of monetary and fiscal policy amid the absence of fiscal responsibility by elected officials. Hence, part of the reason for the increase in volatility of currencies is due to the unbalanced dependence on monetary policy in the current environment. There's been a call by some in politics for the FOMC to be dissolved and Congress take over those responsibilities. On a personal note, I'm sometimes not a fan of the Fed, whose actions are often conducted under the cloak of secrecy. But would one really want to dismantle the Fed and have Congress in charge of the financial system of the U.S.? The most recent statistic we found shows that nearly 25% of those in Congress have filed for either personal or business bankruptcy. Not sure we want those folks in charge. From this discussion, one realizes there are many factors determining the value of currencies. The correlation of different commodities to the influence of the U.S. dollar varies sharply, and it's not consistent. The commodities with the best inverse relationships should, not surprisingly, be commodities that either are now or were used as currencies. Yes, those would be gold, silver, and platinum. However, as we review the correlations of the major commodities, crude oil has the best inverse relationship over the past 3 and 5 year periods. We should note the correlations for the U.S. dollar index and cotton were negative 3.6 from January 2007 to May 2015, minus 5.6 from January 2010 to May 2015, and minus 0.66 from January 12th to May 2015. That increased relationship between the price of cotton and the U.S. dollar suggests there's some causality involved in that. In this case, the U.S. dollar, we think, has had a stronger influence than it did several years ago. When the world supply-demand balance becomes better into equilibrium, then that relationship may not be as strong. One of the reasons we think the relationship might weaken is some of the inverse relationship of the U.S. dollar is contingent on the supply-demand balance of the commodity in question. By that I mean, if a commodity is an adequate or relatively large supply over demand, then the value of the U.S. dollar can be more influential on price. When a commodity is in short supply relative to demand, then the demand for the limited supply trumps any influence that the U.S. dollar may otherwise have. The large global supply of cotton in the international market is one of the reasons for the increased influence of the dollar. Another is the increase in participation by speculative interests. The initiation of commodities as an asset class has increased managed money and index investments in all commodities. We noted earlier that the U.S. dollar and crude oil prices have a high correlation, and part of that is due to the international supply glut of crude oil, but also the relative large increase in speculative participation in the futures and options market. Crude oil large specs have had a participation rate of over 50% in the combined futures and options market for the past 47 weeks. Prior to that, on two other occasions, the total times it had been over 50% was 6 weeks. The large speculative funds tend to be less in tune with the specifics of a specific commodity and more in tune to larger macroeconomic factors. That's because many of the hedge and index funds may take a position for multiple years, not viewing an individual crop year on its own, but rather a larger term view of the market. An example is if the fund has an opinion about inflation over a multi-year period, it might hold a long position for several years. That's something that had been unheard of several years ago. That factor, along with technical considerations, is reason for the reputation the specs have for a herd mentality. They tend to all be looking at the same macroeconomic factors and tend to come to similar conclusions, therefore tending to trade together. There's also a follow-the-leader mentality, as smaller to medium-sized funds tend to mimic larger successful funds. There are not a lot of smaller to medium-sized funds who want to go head-to-head against the success of certain traders like maybe a George Soros or Paul Tudor Jones or Goldman Sachs or one of those nature. It's not uncommon for prices to move sometimes long periods against the underlying supply-demand statistics amid the power and influence of those traders. And in the case of crude oil, the specs are, at least statistically, larger currently than the commercials. For that reason, the weekly commitment of traders report is important. I often consider the importance of that report almost as a fundamental factor. When the spec position becomes imbalanced, or just during a period when specs decide to liquidate positions, prices can move sharply. The report is also broken down into categories that include merchant traders, money managers, and index funds. The report allows one to have an idea of how the different categories of traders may be positioned in a given week. It's therefore critical that any student of the market be informed of trader positions in the report. Another less common factor for price movement, not directly related to supply-demand factors, is the CFTC Cotton On-Call Report. The Cotton On-Call Report is published weekly as of information received through the previous Friday. The way to think about the report is from a traditional cotton merchant hedge perspective. That is, the on-call sales position represents a merchant sale to a spinning mill, where the basis is fixed but not yet the price. From the merchant hedge perspective, it represents a futures purchase. That is, because from a traditional merchant hedge perspective, when a fixed price sale is made, the merchant would hedge it with a long future. The opposite, therefore, is true on the on-call purchase. Think of it as a purchase from a farmer where the basis is fixed but not the price and represents a futures hedge sale from the merchant perspective. We recognize the on-call contract could be made between merchants or others, but the perspective for understanding the futures activity is the same. There are a few times that the report is terribly impactful, and it typically is in concert with another event. In 2010-11 crop year, the position was out of balance, and that on-call sales were dramatically larger than on-call purchases. The mills had waited a long time to fix prices because it was one of those scenarios when prices were not reflecting underlying fundamentals, and mills were caught in a position where they had to fix prices as time ran out for them due to their contract specifications. The mill fixing at higher prices than they would have liked did not cause the record high prices, but they contributed to them. These are three parts of our market: the U.S. dollar valuation, the size and direction of the speculative community, and to a lesser degree, the size and balance of the on-call position that can have an impact on cotton market that's not directly related to supply and demand for the physical commodity. Thank you for your kind attention today, and perhaps, Pat, we have some other questions from our listeners or further discussion from our panel.
Well, yeah, we'd like to talk about the crop report. Anybody want to contribute to that, the report that came out yesterday? John?
I'll just size it up. I think the there wasn't much change in the old crop for month numbers, and for the new crop snapshot that we have, you know, the U.S. picture of it is it's a neutral outcome, ending stocks similar for the 15 crop as they are, probably will be for the 14. So no real surprise there.
Anybody else? Anybody else got any thoughts on the report yesterday?
Well, yeah, I had anticipated that they would increase exports marginally rather than bringing them down 100,000.
Okay. Gerald?
I thought they might increase the exports just modestly in the current crop. I thought those were unchanged. Perhaps I'm mistaken. But even so, the number of sales we have on the books right now, I've got to believe that USDA somehow thinks there may be some cancellations or perhaps a larger export rollover than we typically have in order to get those numbers to balance out.
You're right. They won't change.
Yeah, it was 10-7.
Okay. Let's go to John in Texas. John, we have heard about all the rain in West Texas. Can you kind of bring us up to date on that and give us the forecast looking out?
It's been raining in West Texas and Central Texas and South Texas, and probably where it's had its greatest effect is in the south along the Gulf Coast. From the valley to the upper coasts above Corpus Christi, they've had actually problems because of the moisture. There's going to be a lot of prevented planting insurance claims, which poses an interesting question for what the planting numbers are going to wind up being when they're reported in June. But quite a few farmers got their sorghum in first or tried to and couldn't quite get their cotton. And I have heard some pretty radically low estimates of how much cotton did not get in the ground. So I'm curious to see about that. Further west, it's been raining too. I would say the further west you go, it's a net benefit, even if it's delaying field operations, which it is. You know, they're coming out of a drought situation. So there are some huge, not huge, there's some big reservoirs in Altus, Oklahoma, around Wichita Falls. A couple of weeks ago, those reservoirs were like 9% capacity, and now they're either a third or half full from all the rain that's been accumulated. That's like in the Rolling Plains region. It's also been raining on the High Plains, particularly the Upper Panhandle and from Lubbock. Lubbock East got some, just looking at the radar. So anyway, everybody's been getting showers. You know, it's ultimately going to be a good thing. But the question in my mind is, are we being set up? Because we do have an El Nino forecast, you know, full blown. That's what NOAA and the Japanese and the Australian meteorologists are all saying, full blown El Nino, which generally means it rains more in the southern U.S. It's cooler and wetter, while there's potential for drought in India and West Africa and Australia. But if we're wetter, then the question in my mind is, are we getting set up for another 2007-2010 where we have really low abandonment and really, really high yields, particularly on the millions of acres of dry land that'll go in. So there's a kind of a production possibilities question in my mind from what's developing. And the last thing is, further west again, because of the moisture, I think that is going to probably alter some intentions for planting, not because they can't get in because it's too wet, but because it may be moist enough that they can get away with a grain crop outright. Again, the planting picture may be somewhat altered than what was reported as late as March, so I'm really curious to see what shakes out.
Okay. Oway, give us your perspective on the Mid-South and the Southeast as far as planting progress and conditions go, what you know?
Progress is very much on average now. We're getting behind a bit. It's been very wet as well. However, we had a pretty good week this past week, and I think we probably caught up a great deal. And with this week being somewhat open, I think by and large, both the Southeast and Mid-South are very much on schedule.
Okay. Let's go to Gerald. Gerald, what are things like in California and Arizona?
Well, they're pretty dry in California, but the crop is ahead of schedule. We're already squaring The crop generally looks pretty good. Everybody's pretty pleased with it right now. You go to along the river, the Colorado River, Blythe, Yuma area, they're well ahead of schedule. West of Phoenix, well ahead of schedule. In fact, even the guys who planted some grains, they're ahead of schedule, and they're thinking that there may be some opportunities for some double cropping between the grains and cotton. You start moving into central Arizona and then the eastern Arizona, and the further east you go, you get progressively a little bit behind. Central Arizona is probably about average, and then you move to eastern Arizona, that's starting to run a little behind. Go into New Mexico, that's getting a little bit further behind as well. But overall, I think that the crop between California, Arizona, New Mexico, and that far west Texas region is we're either ahead or just about where we need to be for this time of year.
Okay. We've got some questions that have come in, and I'll ask these of our group. And the first question is from Mississippi. It looks like it's a two-part question, and it's how can I be expected to plant cotton this year at these prices? And the second part is, after selling my cotton pickers this year, how can I be expected to grow cotton next year? OA, you got any thoughts on that?
Well, that is a major step in getting rid of the pickers. So obviously, you're locked into commercial picking. You can't be expected if the market's not there. That's just the bottom line. It's so this year basically says cotton is questionable. However, depending on what your grades historically are, you just need to analyze the difference in what the medium and the coarse count cotton prices are versus your higher grade cotton. In Mississippi, the Southeast in general, this past year finally elevated its quality of production. And we just have to look at those prices vis-a-vis the New York board price, because the New York board reflecting more of a coarse count cotton. So, now it's very difficult to evaluate what you want to do without having a good control over what you think your acreage and yield will be. As far as not having pickers, obviously, then you're stuck with just a commercial operation that gets your cut when you're ready.
Okay. Here's another. Yeah, I don't know. Here's another question. Who is responsible for the current farm bill with regard to cotton, and can changes be made to it specific to cotton, the current farm bill? Gerald, you want to take that one?
Well, I can attest that I don't think that there's any desire of anybody for wanting to reopen the farm bill to make any changes. I suppose if you can make some changes, some minor changes without opening the farm bill, that's about the only way you're going to do it. A couple of weeks ago, just happened to be in Pat Roberts' office, and we were talking about the payment limitation issues with respect to pulling LEP and marketing loan gains and everything, and the first thing Pat Roberts said is, hey, we worked too damn hard on this farm bill for 3 years. We're not opening the farm bill, so give me your pitch. There doesn't seem to be a big desire to help people, but when you start explaining the situation with respect to payment limitations and marketing loan gains, that it doesn't make a lot of sense when you have a marketing loan and you restrict how much a producer can pull out of the marketing loan gains. You don't really have a marketing loan anymore. I think that's starting to sink in, but I'm not sure if anything will happen with regards to that. So, again, if you want to make a change to a farm bill without opening the farm bill, there's probably opportunities there.
Okay. Here's a question, and I'll direct this to Kip. What have the low energy prices done to synthetic fabrics market share?
Surprisingly, they haven't had the impact that you would think because of overproduction of the synthetics. Actually, synthetic prices are still cheaper than cotton, where you would expected the prices to have changed. We've had this little rally in the energy prices right now, but it really the synthetic prices have stayed low and they remain low. So cotton in China has become a little bit more competitive, but it hasn't been much. So the situation with synthetic fibers right now is primarily overcapacity in China and India. So, you know, you would have thought that when the prices did go down, you got a big drop in synthetics. When they made this little bounce up, you would have thought there would have been a better price increase than we've gotten. But the difficulty is that the man-made fibers are still very, very competitive against cotton in the Asian markets.
Okay. Let's go around the group here and get some thoughts on cotton prices. We can look at old crop and new crop, but Kip, let's start with you. Give us your range of what you think prices can do looking out here for cotton. How low it can go, how low it can go, and how high it can go.
Well, whatever I think on the highs or lows, I'm going to be proven incorrect just about every time. But my thoughts right now on the range for July is about a 61-62 cent low, more like a 62. Maybe you can take us back up to about 68 cents. But I think we're in a trading range right now. The market has shown us when you get down to around that 62 cent area, something between 62 and 63 cents. The international community is ready to buy U.S. cotton. We're at a situation where our sales are such we may not need to add a whole lot more to our books. So I think that's kind of the low end. Some of these merchants, I think, are still a little bit short. They're mostly well covered, but there's a little bit of a quality concern. So they may be able to run prices up if they decide to come out here and have to cover some cotton. So my range for current crop is about 62 to 68 cents or so. New crop, you know, John made an excellent point a moment ago about the potential for a really large crop if everything works out the way it could. And so I think there's more downside on December. We may be able to get to the high 50s for that. The high end of that, again, is likely around your 68, 69 cents. It's going to be pretty hard to get it in the 70s, I think, unless we get some sort of a crop problem outside the U.S. Of course, there is the wild card yet. The Northern Hemisphere crop is still being planted. There are things out there that can change the planting picture. So new crop, of course, got a little bit more variability to it. But that's sort of what I'm thinking right now.
Okay. Gerald, let's go to you and get your thoughts on price.
Well, I would completely agree with Kip on old crop, 62 downside, 68 upside. It's amazing just how quiet it is out there right now as far as the demand is concerned. I'm not sure if these mills are finding other growth more attractive or they just don't need the cotton as far as U.S. cotton is concerned. But so I think we can move lower in old crop, but because of the potential for more sales, you know, you could run back up to that 68 cent area. As far as new crop is concerned, you know, it's just going to be all about production. And with this El Nino and the uncertainty of it, I do think that you still have a good chance to run into the 70s, particularly if we have a late harvest here in the United States, regardless of the size of the crop and if there are needs to to get cotton out in a timely fashion early in the season. But, you know, if you have crop problems, not just a late crop, but let's say a late and smaller crop than expected, not only here in the United States, but abroad, then yes, I think you'll stay in the upper half of that range. But on the downside, yeah, you could see 50 cents. So let's call it 58 cents on the low side, and possibly as high as 74 cents on the top side.
Okay, John.
Yeah, it's scary, but I'm pretty much in agreement with what I'm hearing. Old crop, if you look at prices versus export sales, there's this band of 62 to 67 or so that goes back to October probably. So anyway, so I'm in agreement with that. And on the new crop side, Gerald just articulated the supply, the production, you know, upside and downside risk, and it's there. I mean, if the monsoon is dry, and, you know, there could be a big shortfall in production there and a few other places, which would be bigger than even if we had surplus production more in the east when they plant late and have a lot of moisture, and Texas has a 2007 kind of year, that would still be outweighed by a you know, 8 million bale shortfall in India. So a lot of trade-offs and possibilities. I'll buy into like 60 to, or I'd say 58 to 70, nice 12-cent range.
All right. OA, what are your thoughts on cotton prices?
Not a whole lot different. I'm not quite as negative on the downside to new crop. I don't feel like we get down into the very high 50s. I think the 60 mark, 61-cent mark that's also supported for July is very active in December. So that the bottom of that range holds me for both July as well as new crop. And, you know, that's 67 up to 68 cents on just basically that same current range that we've been seeing in July for some time, though we have stretched a cent to the top side recently. But that range is going to be in play. I had thought very seriously that we would see a 70-cent trip to July. I don't anticipate that now. There's just too much coarse count cotton left, and it's just not going to let the market move higher above that range, in my opinion. Of course, the quality cotton that's out there will continue to draw that level, but not the bulk of all this medium quality cotton, the Ciclo buildings, 16th, whatnot. New crop, 74 cents top side. I would agree with, I think maybe Gerald had said that. Kip, but it's right up in the 70 cent area, with John. So I think that's what we see with the new crop. And it is, as they both indicated, we're right in the very real planting season, so to speak, and we just got to see what Mother Nature will give us. So often, and as John, I think, in the past has pointed out, that we get a lower abandonment percentage coming off the El Nino in West Texas. So looking at a lower than normal abandonment, and I think
Are you away? Are you there?
He doesn't know he's talking into.
Okay, I didn't know if it was me or him. OA, can you hear us, OA? Okay. We've lost OA. I looked up at the screen when we started talking. Cotton was up about 5 to 10. Now it's up 55 to 60. July's trading 65-60 right now, up 58. December's up 55. It's 65.38. I looked to see what's going on. Retail sales came out at 7.30, and suddenly the dollar got hit. Dollar's down 64, and as we've talked about many times, as the dollar goes, it can influence commodities. Gold's up $12 an ounce. Stock market's up. crude oil's up, and grains are up also when they stop trading. So that's what's going on at the moment there. Anybody got anything else they want to add before we conclude? All right. Well, thanks. We thank our sponsors for providing this Ag Market Network teleconference to you. Thanks to Bayer Crop Science, also Cotton Incorporated and Farm Press Publications. Thanks to our speakers, to Dr. O.A. Cleveland, Dr. John Robinson, to Gerald Nieper, and special thanks to our lead speaker today, Kip Butts. We hope you'll join us tomorrow at 7:28 tomorrow morning for the E3 Live Market Report. We do it each week to talk about the exports and what's happened for the week. Thanks for joining us on this edition of the Ag Market Network.